And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, continuing with our education series. And my guest this half hour, very exciting, James Loewen is with us, best-selling and award-winning author of what's been recognized as one of the most important history books of our time, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. It won the American Book Award when it came out more than 20 years ago, and has sold nearly 2 million copies since. It's out in a third edition with a new preface. James Loewen, thank you for joining us. James Loewen, are you there? Okay, evidently not there quite yet. We'll be talking to him about some of the fascinating topics in his book. Perhaps you've read since it's been out and sold nearly 2 million copies over the time. He talks in his preface. The preface is actually called Lies My Teacher Told Me in the Age of Alternative Facts. So when we get him on the line, we'll be talking about the rise of fake news and how the treatment of data and evidence has changed in recent years, and if that's ever been time in history when we've had similar circumstances. Jim Loewen, due to join us, we hope, in just a moment. I think I hear something on the line. Jim Loewen, are you there?
I am there. I am here.
And we're here, and we're hearing you loud and clear. Sorry for the technical hiccup there. We're glad to have you now. We'll get right to it. Sociologist, historian, and best-selling author, Lies of My Teacher Told Me, many other books, Lies Across America, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. That's also been reissued, I understand, with a new preface. And Lies My Teacher Told Me About Christopher Columbus. You're a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont. Let's dive right in here. You go by Jim. I hope that's all right.
That's right.
Jim, in the preface to this new third edition, you write about the rise of fake news. How do you place fake news in the treatment that we've come to give data and evidence in this day and age in historical context?
Well, I think that the connection is that we teach U.S. history so poorly in high school, in fact, in K through 12. Not every teacher, I hasten to add, but every textbook and every teacher who relies on the textbook. So we teach it so poorly, K-12, that we have kind of left, shall we say, the brain open for fake news, for alternative facts, and so on, because we haven't taught students how to sift, how to determine whether or not a source is credible, and how to decide whether one causal statement is more accurate than another one.
Hmm. So connect that a little bit more when you say good versus
sure.
bad teaching of history. Give us an example
sure.
or describe what is very good history teaching in high school, let's say, and what would be
sure.
very bad on that spectrum.
Sure. Well, what we are doing, I think, we're not teaching the forest. We're not even teaching trees. We are still teaching twigs. I'm sure many of your listeners remember the endless 55 questions at the end of each chapter that we were supposed to answer. Columbus discovered America in 1491. Well, you know, I'm being a little silly, but and that's the kind of stuff we were supposed to learn, is the notion. Now, right off the bat, the very first issue in American history is how and when did people first get here? And right off the bat, the very first thing that we're not sure of is how and when did people first get here. But instead of letting students in on the fact that there's a magnificent debate going on in archaeology, in anthropology, in physical anthropology, in genetics, and so on, about these matters, the textbooks just tell us, in fact, almost every single one tells us exactly one date, and that was about 13,000 years ago, they walked across Beringia, or the Bering Strait, because the sea level was down, because the ice age was on, and so a whole bunch of water was locked up in the ice over Greenland and over Antarctica, and so they just walked across. Now, We don't know that. And as a matter of fact, there's almost no evidence for it. The main piece of evidence that there is for it is that the big group of American Indians, that is, all of Native Americans with the exception of people called the Dene people and people called the Inuit or Eskimo people, but all the other groups are one group originally, and they are related physically and culturally to people in northeastern Asia, in Siberia. That's the only evidence. But the evidence that they walked and also the evidence that they came 13,000 years ago isn't there. Mm-hmm. Now, absence of evidence doesn't mean it happened, but we are now finding all kinds of dates, even in places like Brazil, that were 35,000 years ago or 25,000 years ago. And so what we need to do right from the start then is get students thinking. And thinking is something that isn't done much in U.S. history course. Instead, it's just, quote, learning.
So you're connecting it to the lack of this ability to critically think,
yeah,
you think is tied in with our present-day treatment of data and evidence where we have the subjective being put on the same level, it seems, in many cases, as something that is has data and evidence behind it.
Yeah, and wouldn't it be great if in that very first unit, some students said, well, it is 13,000 years ago, and here's my evidence, and some other folks said, no, I think it's 35,000 years ago. Then we might even have some students who took their answer out of religion. You know, there are Mormons, for example, who would assert, well, they are the native people are the remains of the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and so that means it has to be after the following day. Incidentally, the leadership of the Mormon Church has abandoned that claim as a whole. But, you know, lots of Mormons still say that. Then there's other beliefs. Native Americans have their own beliefs. But one of the things we have to help students do is separate religious beliefs from matters of fact, if you will, and learn to compartmentalize. And we all compartmentalize. I'm not talking about anything kind of hypocritical. And that way, students would begin to get a reasonable understanding of why we accept this website and not that website, and why we accept the vetting that went on with regard to these footnotes and not this other paper that doesn't have any footnotes, that kind of thing.
If you just joined us, sociologist, historian, best-selling author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, it's out in a new edition. Jim Lowen is with us. We're so pleased to have him on the show for a few minutes. Let's go to a caller. You can join us in the next few minutes. Jim will be with us, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Karen is with us from Waukee. Hi, Karen. Thanks for tuning in. Your question for Jim Lowen.
Well, my question was prompted by the last segment, but I think it's appropriate here as well. And my question was, how do teachers deal with the sense of or the notion of equivalency in their classrooms when we have students on one side and others on the other of a situation such as Charlottesville, where our president asserted that there were good people on both sides of the white supremacy and the not white supremacy argument. And it seems to me when this speaker started, he has a book about lies my teachers told me, and I think there's a teacher being confronted with, in my opinion, what could be called lies my students told me about the rightness or wrongness of one side or the other. And I don't know how teachers exactly navigate that.
Right, Karen, a great point there and great example, because you also write about the period of the Confederacy, what was behind the succession of the states. How do you answer, Karen? Jim?
Well, let me make a couple of answers. First of all, it's a good point. It's more a point than it is really a question. In the new preface to Lies My Teacher Told Me, the very first illustration is actually a pair of illustrations. I've got them precisely matched so that they are in exactly the same position. And they show the National Mall, and the first one shows the National Mall on the occasion of the first inauguration of Barack Obama, and the second shows the National Mall on the so far first inauguration of Donald Trump. And this gets into the issue of alternative fact, because that phrase was really coined by a couple of Trump people, but particularly by a woman named Kellyanne Conway, to describe the assertion that Trump's crowds were the biggest ever. Trump's crowd was the biggest ever. Well, you can simply look at these two photos and see that that's not true. And so the false equivalency, the student who says, well, I have my fact and you have your fact, gets shot down then by the fact that we can't just have those are two opinions, really, and the facts on which they're based, those are up for grabs, and they're not just up for grabs. They have to be real facts, and in this case, they are really, in one case, proven false by the photos. Now, the Confederacy, of course, ties right into the issue of Charlottesville. Really, ever since 1890, people that I call and that usually are called neo-Confederates, because they are pro-Confederate, but they have but it's a new generation. They've been arguing that the Confederate states seceded for states' rights, that slavery had very little to do with it. And in fact, I have actually spent a fair amount of the last 12 years asking all kinds of teachers and college students and high school students and just regular folks, people who come to a talk at a museum or whatever, I've been asking them, why did the South secede?
Mm-hmm.
And you always get four answers, but up until the last 2 years, the answer that gets over half the votes has always been states' rights. And it doesn't make any difference whether I asked the question in North Carolina, which is the first place I asked it, or whether I asked it in northern Minnesota, which by pure chance I asked it there a week later. And now I've asked it in North Dakota, and I've asked it in Southern California. I've asked it of overwhelmingly black teaching staff in Memphis, Tennessee. And they all gave it over 50%, in fact, 60 to 65% answered states' rights. Well, it turns out that that answer is exactly as false as the idea that Donald Trump's crowd was larger than Barack Obama's. It's simply false, and we know that because we can go to the primary sources. And I, in fact, edited a book called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader in order to get those primary sources out in a more easy form, but they're all on the web.
Right, and
when you read them, you find out, well, they're all saying that they're against states' rights. In fact, they are seceding because they're upset with various northern states and what they're doing to interfere in little ways with slavery. And so it's all about slavery. There's no two right answers. It is slavery. And again, once you help students understand that, then they have to come to terms with the worship of the Confederates, as is promulgated on our landscape by all these massive monuments, is inappropriate.
Right. And I can back you up as an elementary student of the Iowa public school system in the 1970s, Jim, I back you up 100%. We learned about the state seceding. It was states' rights, and slavery was a side thing. Abraham Lincoln would have accepted slavery or not having slavery. That was really a side issue. So the question is, how did we get that to be the narrative, even in a northern state like Iowa, when you say it is, as in terms of black and white, it's not true?
Yeah, it's utterly not true. Well, that's a very good question, and it all happened around 1890. Let me say that Lies, my teacher told me, points out that the number one quotation that the textbooks like to use from Abraham Lincoln is not the Gettysburg Address, like most people would assume it would be. Rather, it is a letter that Lincoln wrote to the newspaper editor of the New York Tribune in the late summer of 1862, Horace Greeley, and he meant it for publication. And in that letter, and you were alluding to this when you made that statement about Lincoln, Lincoln says something about, if I could save the Union and free all slaves, I would do it. And if I could save the Union and free no slaves, I would do it. And if I would save the Union and free some slaves and leave the rest in bondage, I would also do that. What I do about slavery, I do in order to save the Union. And what I forbear in order to save the Union. Now, that implies that Lincoln didn't give a damn about slavery, that he was only in it to save the Union. And that's their favorite quote. And they leave out the very next sentence in which Lincoln says, I mean no contradiction between my view of official duty and my oft-expressed wish that all men would be free. Well, that says something quite different about slavery, so let's leave that out. And so now you might complexify your question by saying, why in the world, from 1890 on, would we want to leave out the notion that Abraham Lincoln was actually an idealist, that he actually did give a damn about slavery? What's wrong with letting him give a damn about it? You
right.
know, what's wrong with that?
Right.
And the answer is that in 1890, we took a turn for the worse. And there is a name for this. Historians call it the nadir of race relations, or nadir, N-A-D-I-R. Nadir is, of course, an English language word. It means low point, the opposite of zenith. And between 1890 and 1940, we actually got worse and worse in terms of race relations. Then I explain this in Lies My Teacher Told Me, and it's even more apparent in the book Sundown Towns, because between 1890 and 1940 is when town after town across Iowa and across the Midwest, I grew up in central Illinois, and across places like Pennsylvania and Oregon, these towns drove out their black population, or if they didn't have a black population, they decided formally or informally that they were never going to have one. And towns like Manning, Iowa, for instance, put up a sign at the city limits saying, and I'm going to have to use the N-word here because that's what the sign said. It said, nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Manning. And Manning, therefore, became a sundown town. Now, you don't have to have a sign. Most towns never had signs, but they just had the determination that they were going to keep black folks out. So I wrote this book, Sundown Towns, and I expected to find maybe 10 of them in Illinois, my home state, and maybe 50 of them across the country. But to my astonishment, I'm now at a count of 506 in Illinois alone, which is 70% of all the towns that there are in Illinois. I think a similar percentage affected Iowa, affected Oregon, and various other northern states. And I might add, this is not a southern phenomenon. White southerners thought this was crazy. I have an account in my book of a rich white family from Alabama that moved to Indiana. And they had to send their maid back home to Alabama lest she be killed. And they say, you people are crazy. You don't even know how to run race relations. Who's going to do the dirty work?
We have just 5 minutes left. There's so much packed into your many books here, Jim Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Lies Across America, Sundown Towns. Two of those books reissued. I wanted to have a quick word before you left this conversation, Jim, because I found it fascinating in your book, and something we don't often think about why history textbooks are the way they are. The process, the pressure that the producers, the role of textbook adoption boards, censorship, publisher censorship. Encapsulate that for us as we end this program.
Sure. I know quite a bit about that because I actually was the head author of a history textbook called Mississippi Conflict and Change, dating to my 7 years of life in Mississippi when I realized how bad the Mississippi state history textbook was. And after we wrote a book so good that it won the Lillian Smith Award for the best nonfiction book produced in the entire South for that year, the state of Mississippi rejected it for public school use, and we had to sue them, and we eventually did win the lawsuit. It's called Lowen et al. Versus Turnipseed et al. Yes, there are people in Mississippi named Turnipseed. And so I know all about it, and of course I've studied Texas and so on. The issue is actually broader than Texas. The main issue, I think, lies with the publishers themselves. In the second edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me, I actually proved that the publishers do not hire the people whose names are on their textbooks as authors. They rent those names. They pay them off for using the names. But then the books are written by clerks. They're written by little hires that we don't know what their names are, that are deep in the bowels of the publisher. And so these folks write, you know, stuff they're not prepared to write. They mostly just copy old books. And so they don't really even have the knowledge or the social status to write any kind of pioneering or accurate textbook. They just copy the old textbooks.
So we have about a minute to go. So is that the state of affairs now? And do you see that changing in its final minute?
That is still the state of affairs. Publishers don't want to offend anybody, and they might offend neo-Confederates if they said flatly that the Southern states seceded for slavery. So they say it, but they say it in such a mystical, vague way that most people conclude it was states' rights and not slavery. They just don't want to offend anybody, and so the worst thing of all is the books are so very boring.
Right. Well, what are your thoughts about the as we go forward after the success of your book in pointing out lies my teacher told me, the way, you know, history has been misrepresented in so many of our educations?
Well, a lot of teachers.
Very quickly, we only have 30 seconds left. Sorry,
yep.
Jim.
A lot of teachers are doing a very good job of teaching against the textbooks. And in fact, some school districts actually have me come do a workshop for them to help teachers understand how to go beyond the textbook and how to teach against the textbook. And students love to prove that this big, boring book is actually wrong, and then they've proven something for themselves.
Makes it exciting.
Yeah.
Jim Lowen, what a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for making time for us.
I'm delighted to speak across Iowa. I really know the state quite well, and I really enjoy it every time I'm there.
All right. Thank you. Jim Lowen, sociologist, historian, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's been reissued with a new preface. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. We also had help today from Alex Dill in Ames and in Des Moines from Michael Leland. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.